From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, from punk rock to spoken word, we meet Henry Rollins. His stage monologues have been compared to Lenny Bruce's because of their dark, honest comedy. Also, the tragicomedy of an accommodating person. We talk with novelist Charles Baxter. His latest novel is a modern-day Faustian tale about a nice guy who goes too far trying to do good. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Clinton held his first post-inaugural meeting with the bipartisan congressional leadership today. Although the agenda was meant to highlight the economy and health care reform, the controversial issue of gays in the military could not be ignored. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
President Clinton plans to formally announce his intention to lift the ban on gays in the military this week, despite opposition in the military and in Congress. After his meeting with congressional leaders, the number two Republican in the House of Representatives, Newt Gingrich, asserted that Congress had a constitutional role in changing the rules that govern military behavior. And Gingrich warned that if Mr. Clinton ignored lawmakers' role in this matter, it would make it harder for the president to work with Congress on other issues. But other congressional leaders were less threatening. The number two Republican in the Senate, Alan Simpson, said he was sure something could be worked out. The Senate Majority Leader, George Mitchell, said he thought it was unlikely the matter would ever come to a vote. Efforts are underway to get Sam Nunn, the chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee and an outspoken opponent of lifting the ban, on board. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
Congress appears likely to give swift passage to a bill that would require larger employers to give workers up to 12 weeks of unpaid leave a year to take care of new babies or family illnesses. The bill was a campaign issue for President Clinton, who criticized former President Bush for vetoing two versions of the legislation. The Bush administration said the measure placed an unnecessary burden on American businesses. Today, the Family and Medical Leave Bill was approved by the Senate Labor and Human Resources Committee on a vote of 13-4. A Russian court has set a trial date for the 12 men accused of leading the failed 1991 coup against then-Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev. NPR's Mike Schuster reports from Moscow.
The trial of the coup plotters has been set for April 14th in Russia's Supreme Court. Most of the defendants have been in prison since the coup failed on August 21, 1991. They will now be freed pending trial, provided they pledge not to leave Moscow. Among them are former Prime Minister Valentin Pavlov, former Vice President Gennady Inayev, former Defense Minister Dmitry Azov, and the former KGB Director Vladimir Kurchkov. The investigation into the coup ended a few months ago. Since that time, the defendants have been studying the evidence against them and preparing their defense. Last month, that phase of pretrial preparation was completed and the case was handed over to the court. Today, a court spokesman said the defendants would be released from prison because they are all elderly. In some cases, their health has suffered, and they have already spent a year and a half in custody. It is believed Mikhail Gorbachev will be called as a witness when the trial begins. I'm Mike Schuster in Moscow.
Stock prices closed slightly higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained nearly 7 points to close at 3,299. Advances led declines by a slight margin in heavy trading. This is NPR News. The Missouri Supreme Court has dismissed a controversial right-to-die case against the father of a woman who's been in a coma for almost 10 years. The dismissal came in response to a request from the state's new Attorney General, Jane Nixon. Nixon was fulfilling a campaign pledge to stop the state's fight against the removal of the feeding tube that's keeping Christine Busalaki alive. Busalaki was a minor when she was injured in an auto accident in 1983, and her father contended that he had the right to interpret her wishes and have the feeding tube disconnected. A lawyer for the father says he has no immediate plan to disconnect the feeding tube. The head of a lobbying group for the big three automakers is denying a newspaper report that domestic car companies are planning to file a complaint charging all import automakers with trade violations. Don Gagne reports from Detroit.
The New York Times says domestic automakers have determined that there's widespread dumping of foreign cars in the U.S. market. meaning the vehicles are being sold here for less than they would be sold in their home markets. The paper cites anonymous sources in its story. But Tom Hanna, head of the American Automobile Manufacturers Association, says no decision on pursuing dumping charges has been made. He adds, however, that his organization is constantly scrutinizing the actions of foreign companies selling cars in the U.S. Last year, the Big Three were unsuccessful in a similar case, focusing only on minivans sold here by the Japanese companies Mazda and Toyota. But analysts say there is a feeling that the Clinton administration will be more likely to support such charges than were the Bush and Reagan administrations. For National Public Radio, this is Don Gagne in Detroit.
International Business Machine said today that it will reduce its dividend by more than two-thirds after reporting record losses last week. The cut had been expected after IBM posted the biggest yearly losses ever for an American industrial company. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. One of the more recent and increasingly popular forms of theater is the autobiographical monologue. My guest Henry Rollins may strike you as an unlikely candidate for this kind of performance because he comes from the world of punk rock, where vocals usually had more to do with aggressive attitude than narrative development. But believe me, he's awfully good at his talking performances. Rollins first became known as the vocalist with Black Flag. Reviewing his spoken word show for the Cleveland Plain Dealer, Roberto Santiago wrote, "What makes Rollins a remarkable performance artist is his ability to instantly bring insight and humor into tragic events without coming off as a preachy educator or a rehearsed nightclub comic." Rollins' talk performances have been released by Imago Records. I asked him about the difference between performing with his band and standing on stage alone telling stories.
Well, with the music, it's usually a very humorless, very violent, explosive affair. And with the spoken word, it tends to lend itself more towards smiling and laughing and enjoyment like that.
So it brings out different parts of your personality?
Yeah, well, you know, you lock a mere mortal in a room with a band on 11 and a bunch of people sweating and, you know, what's he supposed to do, sit there and act like he's, you know, going to the dentist or something? I mean, there's different levels of excitement, and I don't go out and do talking shows and stand there and jump up and down and scream. So, you know, the talking shows tend to be a bit more low-key in some ways, like overall volume.
Mm-hmm.
But the intensity is pretty much the same level both times.
You're the kind of person who would definitely stand out in a crowd, just visually even. You have enormous muscles from bodybuilding, a really kind of developed neck from bodybuilding. You have tattoos down your arm and the back of your neck and on your back. So I guess you'd have to be wearing at least a short-sleeve shirt to see some of this. Do strange things happen to you when you're in a group of people because of the way that you stand out?
Oh, well, yeah, people have been staring at me, looking at me funny since I was about 20 years old. So it's all right.
So how did you start bodybuilding?
Well, I don't do that. I just lift a lot of weights. There's a lot of, it's kind of a different approach. I lift for fitness and strength and, you know, because I like life. But I've been working out since I was about 14 on and off. But the last 4 or 5 years, mainly on, and more, and you know, in the last 5 years, it gets more and more to where now I go in about 6 days a week.
What are the tattoos you have on your arms?
All kinds of things. I mean, I know we're talking to people out there in radio land, but I don't know. There's lots of stuff. You know, it's not something I sit down and talk about. You know, some people feel the need to get tattoos. Obviously, in my case, it comes from some kind of insecurity where just being born wasn't good enough. I had to customize myself in a certain way. I guess perhaps as to not sort of not look like my mother and father or anyone else. And obviously working off an insecurity, as do most people who take the stage.
So have you often been kind of like singled out by either police or by punks because of the way you look?
I've been singled out by police in major cities all over the world at different times, which is too bad because I'm not a criminal type. You know, I don't do that which is illegal. You know, I don't hurt people or mug people or break into their homes or anything. So to walk the streets of Los Angeles and have a cop pull you over, you know, as you're walking and call you a bunch of names and threaten you is kind of hard to take.
Let me read a catchy quote of yours. I was raised to hurt myself and hate myself. Would you explain that?
It's interesting that you said it's catchy.
Yeah.
Well, if I would have fully realized the vision my parents had set out for me, I would have turned into just a self-effacing and eventually self-erasing person, you know, who would cower and shake. I mean, spending time with my father was basically walking tiptoe on rice paper through a minefield. The mission was get through the weekend and don't get backhanded. You know, don't get smacked in public. Don't get whacked. That was how I used to deal with my dad. It was never about conversation or learning anything. It was just don't do the wrong thing and get belted. And so that kind of makes you kind of a fidgety, nervous person when you're young. And you get very prone to explosive violence and a lot of paranoia. And on my mother's side, there's just a lot of fear there, you know, a lot of fear with her boyfriends and just her tension that and her thing that she was going through. And, you know, to go do have all that and then go to an all-boys school at the same time and not be able to relate to women, although you wanted to. By the time I was 18, I was an extremely tense young man.
You went to a military school, didn't you?
Yeah, it's a naval preparatory school. They got people ready for the Naval Academy and West Point. And so all my teachers were ex-military, and there's a real emphasis on athletics and really hard education. And the teachers were allowed to whack the students, and I was on a lot of drugs at the time, not by my own will. It was Ritalin. You know, for hyperactivity.
Oh, I thought they just gave that to kids.
Yeah, they gave it to me till I was about 10th grade, and then I stopped taking it. I was on it from kindergarten up.
Let me get back to the military academy. How did you react to the strict discipline of military training?
Okay, well, it wasn't like we fell out with rifles every morning at 6 a.m., but, you know, it was a dress code that was adhered to, and there was detention. And, you know, you were told to, you know, stand up straight and all that. And it had a good effect on me. I mean, this discipline's a good thing to have. It gets you, you know, up in the morning and gets you where you need to go. My father instilled in me a lot of discipline, and I definitely think it's a virtue. If you notice, anyone who is successful or has traits that you admire, they're usually very disciplined.
How did you use that discipline on yourself? What did you discipline yourself to do?
Well, I always worked after school. You know, I always had money in my pocket because I always had a job. I was working since I was in fourth grade. And I'd work all through the weekend. And anything I was really interested in, I would go at with all speed. You know, I'd study. There's things I was actually interested in besides, you know, running around and, you know, riding a bike into a tree like most young kids. I read books. I read authors. I read about them. I learned about certain animal groups. I went to a pet shop and got a job there just so I could learn about snakes, you know. I had interest.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Henry Rollins, and he's a leader of the Henry Rollins Band and also does a lot of talking performances and has a series of audio cassettes and CDs called The Box Life, and has a video of one of his performances called Talking from the Box. Let's see. When you dropped out of college early on, right?
Yeah, I started in 1979, I guess. And I just found it all very, very boring, you know. I was using my ninth grade math book. My fellow students in the English class were really stupid. And I said, I don't want to do this for 4 years.
So when you left college, what did you do with yourself?
I went out and got a job.
What kind of job?
I worked at an ice cream store. Went in because all my friends worked there, so I got a job there. And after the first day of work, I went to the boss and I said, "Well, you know, you should make me a manager of your store, a shift manager, because I can save you some money here." And I showed him a few different things, and he said, "All right, wise guy, you work here 2 more weeks, and if you don't screw up, we'll make you a manager. If you screw up once, you're out of here." I said, "That's a good deal." I think he liked me, you know. And so he made me a manager, then I became the head manager, and then I pretty much started running the whole place, hiring, firing, inventory, deposits, had the keys to the whole place. I'd be there about 60 hours a week, and then I joined Black Flag and started this life of somewhat dubious celebrity.
Would you tell a story of how you joined the band?
Sure. I was always a fan of the band, and I lived in Washington, D.C., and they lived in Los Angeles. And they would come out to Washington, D.C., where I was living, and they would play, and they would sleep at my friend's house because they were these guys living in a van, and we'd all put them up and feed them and hang out. And they were very nice people, and I really liked the band. It really, they were saying what I wanted to say. You know, they had that rage that I was feeling. And I went to go up to go see them in New York of March of 81 because they were not playing in Washington. So I drove up to New York to see them, took a day off from my job. And they did an after-show party at this small club in the Village. So I went there with them, and they were playing away in this bar just for, like, you know, 50 people who just kind of heard the word and went down there. And I told the guys, I said, "Hey, you know, play the song Clocked In," which is the song about going to work, because I had to leave right from that club and drive down to D.C. and go to work. And I hadn't slept yet, so it was going to be a hard shift. So they said, "All right, let's do Clocked In for Henry." And, you know, they started playing, and I kind of looked at the singer, Dez, and kind of looked at the microphone, and he said, "Here, take it." You know, just gave me the mic, and I just sang the song because I knew it. And everyone in the band was kind of looking at me going, "Wow, that was wild." And everyone in the crowd was kind of nodding their heads like, "That sure was cool." And then I just didn't think anything more of it than, "Wow, I can tell my friends at home I did a song with Black Flag, man. That's pretty bitchin'." So I got in my car and went back down to Washington and worked. And later on that week, the guys in the band called me from New York and said, "Well, you know, we're auditioning new singers because our singer, Dez, wants to move down to rhythm guitar. We really liked what you did the other night. Would you like to come up here and try it out?" I went, "Yeah." So I took a train up there and, you know, sang 2 sets with them. What I knew I sang, what I didn't know I improvised, and I got in the band.
Why don't I play something from your one of your records with Black Flag?
All right.
Dallas, coward, ride the cold. Rise above, we're gonna rise above. Make this score what we say. Rise above, we're gonna rise above. Try to stop what we do. Rise above, we're gonna rise above. When they can't do it themselves. Rise above, we're gonna rise above. Way up high, up yours.
That's Black Flag with my guest Henry Rollins doing the vocals. When you were first performing with Black Flag, what were some of the things that the audience would do as you were performing?
Well, you know, every physical move you could think as far as arms and legs moving around. Sometimes they would get a bit antagonistic. They would hurl objects at the singer's head, put themselves on stage and swing at my face, try and light certain parts of my anatomy on fire with Bic lighters. It was always an interesting adventure at every Black Flag show. You know, music was only part of it. It was...
Did you find yourself both liking and really detesting some of your fans?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, that was the hard part about Black Flag is, boy, some of the people at our shows, I wouldn't ever want to see again. I don't want to know them. You know, guys coming up and Sieg Heiling, you know, skinheads. Mm-hmm. I'm not into that kind of stuff.
Henry Rollins is my guest. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. you're just joining us, my guest is Henry Rollins. He's a writer, vocalist, leads the Rollins Band, and now he has several cassettes, CDs, called The Box Life, of some of his talking performances. There's also a video of one of his talking performances. Let me ask you about something that happened last year, something really awful. Your very close friend of many years was killed, Joe Cole. You were with him. You had just rented a movie, and you were coming home to the house that you shared to watch it when you were held up. Would you tell us what happened?
Yeah, well, me and my pal Joe was coming home from the store, and these two guys came out of the bushes with guns. And they put them in our faces. They said, "This is a hold up," and they held us up. And they said, "We're gonna go into your house now." So I knew they were gonna take us in and kill us. I mean, you know, just I could just see us having to go into the back room and, you know, put our heads on the floor and just get shot. So I just kind of, I don't know. I wasn't all that afraid. Not that I was all brave and was gonna wrestle a gun away from someone. It was just like so factual that you just kind of went, oh, well, this is how it ends up, I guess, you know. I was terrified, but at the same time, you're just like, well, this is all happening so fast, you know. But the guy put the gun in my back, and I had the key, so I kind of led the way, and I had the three of them behind me, Joe and two gunmen. I opened the door, walked into the living room of the house and put my groceries down and stuck my hands in the air and awaited further instruction. And I heard gunshots behind me, and the gunshots stopped, and I ran out the back of the house and ran up the alley and called the cops. And what had happened was the guy had shot Joe. Someone did. I mean, I my back turns. I don't know exactly the sequence of events, but from where I was standing and tracing where the bullets went, the guy shot at me twice and missed me by about, I'd missed my upper back by about 2 inches on my left side and probably about the same on the other side. I think he shot me left to right because the second one went a little wider, which means he was probably on the fly as he was doing it. But Joe was killed on the front lawn, and the cops came and arrested me and took me down to the police station.
You know, you called the cops when you escaped. How did they end up arresting you?
Well, because they got a call about a suspect in dark clothing, a male, and that was me. And so they arrested me, and
Was that your call that said dark clothing, or was that somebody else who called?
No, that was me.
So you described someone in dark clothing, they assumed it was you when they found you.
Uh-huh. I just kind of wandered into the middle of the street in shock, and I saw our local plainclothes car, because I lived in a crack neighborhood, so you get to recognize all the plainclothes cars, and I saw this guy coming the wrong way up the street, so I started flagging him down, so I recognized his car. And he said, you know, the bullhorn came on and said, go to the side of the, you know, curb, put your hands on your head. I said, no, I'm the one who called you, you know, and I started shouting out my street address. And then they got mad. You know, they go to the side of the curb, and they came out, and they had their guns out, and they arrested me. I'm going, no, I'll take you to the place. Come on. And they're like, just get in the car and shut up. So
how was that resolved?
It wasn't.
How did they release you?
Well, they released me 10 hours later. They kept me there overnight because I was the only witness, and I had to wait for the detectives to get back from the scene so I could give my report. You know, they could ask me, and I could, you know, give them a verbal statement of what I saw and what happened.
Were you still a suspect then?
Not really. It was never formally said, we think you did it. I mean, no one ever said, you killed Joe. But what the drag was is these detectives, they need a motive. They don't understand what the reason was why this happened. So they're going, okay, you guys must have been drug dealers. And, you know, the hardest core thing we ever did at that house was like, I think spinach noodles, you know? I mean, we're so lightweight. We were into working out and you know, eating pasta. And, you know, Joe didn't even drink coffee, you know? So that was totally out of the question. But these guys hit me with, they would grill me for months about how Joe and I were coke dealers. It's like, fellas, you know, we're not coke dealers. It's just not an option there. Took them a while to get off that track.
Did you ever try to find the killers?
Me?
Well, I mean...
Get on the public bus and go drive around Venice? Does anyone know anyone who killed anyone around here? No,
but you know what I mean? You can really kind of apply heat to the investigators to
Well,
to
I know the two detectives who are on the case, and there's not a whole lot I can tell them about their job.
Yeah.
And I don't think... they called the other day. They're still on it.
They are.
These guys are really good, and they're really cool people. I don't mind these two detectives, even though they are cops. You know, and I don't think any cop can be trusted. But these guys are definitely into nailing this guy. They're still on it. They called my manager the other day. And so I can't, I mean, I give them every, you know, whenever they say, hey, can you call us in, you know, I guess they're not used to having witnesses be all that cooperative. They said I'm the most cooperative witness they've ever had. Because I give them my tour schedule, I give them all my phone numbers. I go, you know, tell me the day you need me, I'll call you. You know, or if I'm in L.A., I'm going to be in L.A. from here to here. When you need me, call me. I'll go down, look at pictures, you know. They want me to take a polygraph test, and I got nothing to hide. So I said, anytime, anywhere.
You don't still live in a crack neighborhood, do you?
Yeah, I do, because I live in L.A., and L.A. has turned into one big crack neighborhood, unfortunately. I'm not trying to be all dramatic, but I live in Hollywood now, and Hollywood used to be just kind of dirty, you know, where you just didn't want to get any on you. But now my neighborhood, Central Hollywood, has turned into definitely a crack neighborhood. All these Crips have come up from South Central because there's no gangs in Hollywood, and so there's no one really running the streets as far as drug trade. So these guys have a wide open market. So now I got guys on my corner everywhere I go, and they're scary too, really scary guys.
So you must still feel pretty vulnerable in your neighborhood.
Yeah, I feel vulnerable everywhere I go due to the recognition factor, which is kind of unnerving. But in that neighborhood, I don't like going out of my own place after 2 in the morning.
Well, do you think that you're more protected or less protected when you're recognized?
Well, when you get recognized by someone, they always have the jump on you. They know who you are. I don't know who they are. You know, I don't know what they want to do. You know, I don't know when some guy's going to go, hey, you, and they'll hand me a pen and a piece of paper, or they'll be sticking a gun in my face. I don't know. You know, and it's not always pleasant just walking down the street trying to, you know, think about something and just have all of a sudden some guy has his arm around you. He's run up from behind you and have your heart leap up into your throat. And it's like this guy is running, put up his arm around you and going, God, I can't believe it's you. You're like, hey, you know, you shouldn't come up on someone's back like that, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, take care, and thank you very, very much for doing the interview.
Okay, see ya.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
Henry Rollins, his spoken word performances, The Boxed Life, are distributed by Imago Records. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Like, I've been to England 15 times. 15 times! I never liked it once. Every time I go, I go, no, not again, not again! God! I mean, you go there and, like, everyone is so sad. I mean, they're nice people. We meet a lot of people at the shows, and everyone's really wonderful and everything, but you see why Morrissey happens. Only there. It wouldn't have happened here. Whenever I, you know, hear it, it'd be like, oh, come on, cheer up. Have some vitamin C. Here's a gun. Get out there.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Novelist and short story writer Charles Baxter has been called a master at creating loopy, poetic, and meaningfully unhinged psyches. Baxter grew up in a house of eccentrics. Coming up, we discuss his new novel, Shadow Play, about an assistant city manager who brings a chemical plant to town at a terrible, unexpected cost. That's coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Robert Reischauer, director of the Congressional Budget Office, said today on Capitol Hill that the exploding cost of government health care programs could force the nation's budget deficit to $650 billion in 10 years unless changes are made. NPR's John Edstey reports.
Reischauer's estimate is unsettling, and so is his claim that even the health care reform promised by President Clinton will not contribute much to deficit reduction over the next 5 to 10 years. That's because the costs of a program to cover the 35 million Americans who have no medical insurance and the cost of bringing Medicare and Medicaid payments in line with private insurance will offset any initial savings from health care reform. Still, the CBO director said such reform is crucial for deficit control beyond the year 2000. Reischauer told senators a package of spending cuts and tax increases is what's needed now to cut the deficit. He said the country could not grow its way out of the problem, even though, Reischauer said, he believes the economy is finally in a self-sustaining recovery and does not require government stimulus. I'm John Edstey in Washington.
The White House says that President Clinton will speak before a joint session of Congress next month to talk about his economic and legislative plans. A White House spokeswoman says this speech on the 17th will not be a formal State of the Union message to Congress, but a discussion of the new administration's economic package and legislative agenda for the coming year. Earlier today, congressional leaders had called the address a State of the Union message to the nation. In Geneva, at a conference on former Yugoslavia, international mediator Lord Owen has warned that a lifting of an arms embargo could lead to a much broader conflict. NPR's Sylvia Pajoli reports from Geneva.
Lord Owen said that the recent Croatian offensive against a Serbian enclave in Croatia is a good foretaste of what would happen if the arms embargo were to be lifted. The British diplomat, who is co-chairman of the peace conference, said that since the Serbo-Croat ceasefire was reached last year, Croatia has been steadily and illegally rearming. He said that if this pattern were to be repeated legally, then all the parties in Croatia, Serbia, and Bosnia would have modern, sophisticated weapons. He added that what happened this weekend in Croatia would be a birthday party compared to what would happen if arms could flow freely into the region. The Clinton administration is about to review policy toward former Yugoslavia, and one option could be proposing a lifting of the embargo, which was imposed by the UN Security Council. This is Sylvia Poggioli in Geneva.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up nearly 7 points to close at 3,298.95. on volume of 313 million shares. Trading today was heavy. This is NPR News. President Clinton has chosen former U.N. ambassador in the Bush administration, Thomas Pickering, as ambassador to Russia. The last person in the Moscow post was former Democratic Party chairman Robert Strauss. Pickering is a career Foreign Service diplomat who has served in a number of top-level diplomatic jobs for several presidents. He is now ambassador to India. The parliament of the newly independent Czech Republic has elected Václav Havel as president. After his election, he pledged to promote political stability and what he called a moral dimension in politics. Burton Bolag has more from Prague.
Václav Havel, former dissident playwright who became Czechoslovakia's president after the fall of communism, has remained his country's most popular political figure, despite recent slippage in public opinion polls. On January 1st, Czechoslovakia ceased to exist, and today Havel was elected the Czech Republic's first president. He won 109 votes in the 200-member Czech parliament. The only two other candidates, one from the Communist Party and one from the far right, gained far less support. Havel will now lead the country alongside the pragmatic, pro-free market Prime Minister Václav Klaus. The two men cooperate well, but Havel has often provoked tension in Klaus and other politicians as the former dissident playwright strives to keep moral issues high on the agenda. For National Public Radio, this is Burton Bolag in Prague.
Officials of Boeing have announced big cuts in both jobs and production in the wake of financial problems for many airlines. The biggest maker of commercial aircraft reported earnings dropped last year to a third of what the company earned the year before. Boeing said it has not decided as yet how many jobs to do away with, but the number is expected to be large. In trading today in Europe, the dollar moved up against other major foreign currencies. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Charles Baxter is someone I vaguely knew in college. More precisely, I knew people who knew him, and I got the impression that his fellow would-be writers considered him the real thing. Sure enough, he's since written several collections of short stories and two novels that have been much praised. New York Times book critic Michiko Kakutani said he has a knack for finding and describing the fleeting moments that indelibly define a life. His new novel, Shadow Play, like most of his fiction, is set in a small Midwestern town. The town of the novel is Five Oaks. Baxter grew up in the small town of Excelsior, Minnesota, which he says was best known for its amusement park. Shadow Play is about a man's relationship with his wife, his children, his parents, and his town. The main character is an assistant city manager named Wyatt. Here's Baxter reading a passage.
One or two of his classmates, he had heard, had become investors. Investors? From Five Oaks? The idea seemed preposterous, but he had been told all this by Harold, his incompetent but friendly barber. One of the more anonymous members of his high school class, Jerry Schwartzwalder, had gone to Minnesota and somehow made a tidy bundle and was promising to return to Five Oaks and bring that bundle with him, Harold claimed, as he haphazardly cut Wyatt's hair. Wyatt had made himself into a model bureaucrat, good at writing up forms, reading regulations, knowing when to ask the city attorney a question, and when to leave him alone. He fit in. He was learning how to hide information from the city council and the mayor. He had never been quarrelsome and seemed to be able to tell most people what they wanted to hear. When he had bad news to give to someone, he suggested just the right amount of distress by wrinkling his brow. He had a small office close to the coffee machine, near the office for special events, run by a woman named Elise Snyder. It all seemed to be going according to some sort of plan.
And of course, that plan changes kind of soon. Well, at the center of your new novel is the attempt to make a compromise for what at first seems to be the larger good. Wyatt, the main character, meets with an old friend who's left the city, and this old friend has developed successful chemical companies. And the idea is to bring him back into town and get jobs for the cities and a job for Wyatt's cousin. But, of course, it's a chemical company, and the chemicals that are being produced and the byproducts of that production are very dangerous, as it turns out.
Right.
Do you think that this is the typical modern dilemma, having to decide which compromises are really worth it? I mean, these people aren't exactly sitting down trying to do evil, but there's a lot of danger that comes out of this.
Well, there are a lot of trade-offs, and of course I've staked my claim on the belief that in fact it is a common sort of trade-off. I live, for example, about 2 miles away from a medical filtration plant that a few years ago was pumping byproducts into the ground, byproducts of the manufacturing, into the groundwater, so much so that there were suits and countersuits. And when the whole thing came up for adjudication, the usual defense was that there were many, many people being employed by this place. I think that all over the country right now, in various cities and small towns, we're being confronted by the trade-off of employment and, as one of my characters says, spilling a bit of hoo-ha on the floor. There's a lot of hoo-ha being spilled on the floor these days. Everybody knows it. It's just a matter of how much tolerance we have for hoo-ha.
So you are not the kind of assistant city manager type person who would be cutting deals to bring chemical plants into town in the hopes that it would revive the economy and open new job possibilities. I mean, you're a writer and teacher. But there must have been other potentially compromising decisions you've had to make in your life that kind of resonated with the decision that you've put into this book?
Anybody who teaches in a university learns plenty about compromises and about bureaucracies. So there's that to start with. And it also seems to me that I'm in possession of an interesting, well, I'm not sure whether it's a virtue or a character flaw. It's the fact that I tend to be rather accommodating, particularly for temperamental people. And when I began to think about this novel, I started to think of it as the tragedy or, let's say, a tragicomedy of a particularly accommodating person, the sort of nice guy who tries to do the right thing for everybody and who gets himself into a terrible pickle because given the kind of job he has and the sorts of things that the town requires of him, that his cousin requires of him, he can't be a nice guy for everyone, and before very long, he has made some decisions that are virtually criminal in their implications.
Was there a turning point type event in your life where you realized that you had gone too far in accommodating somebody?
Well, I don't know if there is or not. I think that when you are a child of temperamental, interesting, but temperamental parents, the youngest son of three children, you find sometimes, or let's say I found, that I was, in fact, sometimes accommodating myself too well. It's interesting to me that the self-help movement is in part meant for people of my type, people who have been nice guys, who have been accommodating, who've tried to do their best for others and sort of have forgotten how to say no to things.
If you're just joining us, my guest is writer Charles Baxter. His new novel is called Shadow Play. Let's take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Charles Baxter is my guest, author of the new novel, Shadow Play. Let me get back to your parents. You described your parents as temperamental.
Mm-hmm.
The mother in your novel is well, insane. I mean, kind of crazy. I don't know what word to use. You help me here. Insane?
No. I never thought of her as insane. I've always been somewhat annoyed by the way people with emotional trouble are presented in fiction, and I thought that what I would do with this woman was to present a character for whom nothing made much sense anymore, and so she sounds crazy to other people around her, but in fact she always made sense to me. But if you're asking me if my mother was like that, I'd have to say no, she wasn't. My stepfather was about as eccentric as people ever have to be, but my mother, no, she wasn't.
In what way was your father eccentric?
Well, my stepfather had at some point early in his life, read, it seems to me, too many English novels and conceived the idea of buying an estate, which he managed to do during the Depression with some money from his first wife, where he lived very much in the English style, almost out of a novel by Henry James. Some would say the Bostonians. I thought it looked more like the Turn of the Screw. After my father died, I was brought up on this place, which was called World's End. And we had a cook and a caretaker. We had nursemaids and a laundry woman. It all sounds quite enviable, except that the nursemaids who raised me and my brothers were, like the nursemaid in the Turn of the Screw, sometimes a bit nuts. And so it wasn't all peaches and cream out there.
The aunt who actually raises the children in this novel, who raises the main character when he was mm-hmm. young, she's writing a new version of the Bible, mm-hmm. a pretty eccentric thing to do.
It is? I don't know why more people don't do it.
What inspired you to create a character who did it?
Well, I thought that in this culture where everything is altered and changed every few months or so, that there might quite conceivably be a character who has the feeling that the God that she experiences happens not to be the God in the Bible. Now, if that's true, then you either have to find a Bible that has that God in it, or you have to write your own Bible. And she's a fairly headstrong woman, and she thinks that the God that she experiences, which is always right behind her, she can never quite turn around to see it, but it's always there, and which has no gender, by the way. She doesn't feel that it's either a he or a she. It's a principle. It's a feeling. And what it is a principle of curiosity. It's a watcher God that wants to see everything happen and happen over and over again. It likes to see these things happen, but it doesn't love us. She thinks that the God who loved us is gone, and this other God has taken the first God's place. And since nobody else is around to write the Bible about this new God, she just settles in and does it. She's a great one for collecting what she calls evidence. Her house is filling up with old newspapers, old magazines, records of whatever happens or has happened in the world, because that's what this God has brought on.
You know, growing up with temperamental parents and eccentric nursemaids, do you think that that turned you into an accommodating person because the people around you were so demanding and in some cases maybe off the beam?
Well, if you're raised by people who have more or less taken leave of the house and put you in the care of nursemaids who have in some way or other found their soul on another planet, I guess you'd be fairly accommodating. Sure you would. My brothers put up some resistance to this and were promptly sent off to military school. So I saw the handwriting on the wall, and since I wasn't much for the disciplines of military school, I learned what it meant to go along. Now, I don't think that's really a good thing, but I do think that in a culture of bureaucracy, many people have, in fact, learned this skill to their surprise and in some ways to their, well, maybe horror is too strong a word, but it's the one that comes to mind.
Are eccentrics attracted to you because they recognize that you would understand them and maybe be accommodating toward them?
Yes, I used to wonder about this. It seemed to me that I had the most peculiar set of acquaintances. I don't mean my close friends. I mean the people who had a tendency to call me up and to talk for an hour or two. My wife never understood why I listened to these people. But I think there's something to be said for the fact that if you want to hear true prophecy, you'd better listen to the people who don't know how to stop talking. That if you really want to hear the wisdom of the wisdom and the strangeness of the age being expressed, you'd better keep your eyes and your ears open to folks of this kind. I seem to have known quite a few of them, and the fact is that I've always enjoyed their company, starting with my aunt and her friends and going down to the people that whom I know now.
Mm-hmm. Novelist Charles Baxter is my guest. He'll be back with us in a minute. This is Fresh Air. President Clinton met with congressional leaders today. Let's see how they're covering it on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Hi, Robert.
Hiya, Terry. Mara Liasson was out in front of the White House when the congressional leaders came out, and then later at the briefing given by George Stephanopoulos. You'll have our report on today's program. Also, John Itzde, on the head of the Congressional Budget Office, testifying about the deficit today on Capitol Hill. Also, Noah Adams talks today with a scientist who was down in Colombia looking inside a volcano when the volcano suddenly exploded. He survived the blast and tells Noah about it. And we also talk with humor columnist Dave Barry about his poll of his readers on the worst rock and roll songs ever.
Any preview?
I can't share it with you. It's still in the sealed envelope.
Okay, well, that and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. My guest is Charles Baxter, author of the new novel Shadow Play. Death has a part in your new novel. How old were you when you lost someone who was very close to you for the first time?
I was 18 months old when my father died very suddenly of a heart attack at a picnic. And although I have almost no memory of, in fact, I have no memory of him and no memory of these events, my two brothers claim that I would go to the upstairs window and wait for him to come home after he had died. It was a place that I usually sat waiting for him. And there's an episode a little bit like that late in my novel, except that I rewrote my own life by having the father come back instead of disappearing, and I rewrote myself as the little boy, Eugene, who waits for the father to come home. That's one of the great pleasures of writing fiction. You can take an episode from your own life and rewrite it in the way that you wish it had happened, but didn't happen. You can't do that too often. After a while, it'll start to look like a set of lies. But you can do it now and then.
So in your own life, you were facing the death of someone close to you before you even comprehended what it was.
My whole life,
even had a memory, really.
My whole life was defined. My whole early life was defined by it. There was no escaping it. Everything that occurred in my life, down to where I lived and whom I lived with, was defined by that death. So I came to think of it as an event, death that is, that defines the way one comes to live. I don't mean that morbidly. I just mean it, I think, in a matter-of-fact way.
Do you feel that as a person you are divided between wanting a family-centered, calm, focused life and wanting something more eccentric, more unusual, more unrestricted?
Yes, I think that's exactly right. I'm very much a homebody. I like I'm very domestic. I once had my auras read by someone who claimed to be psychic, and she said that there was a thick purple aura around me, and that that was the sign of domesticity. And she even saw a visionary dog at my feet with its front paws crossed, and apparently the dog was the sign of what did she say? She said that he was guarding me. Guarding my life. It all seemed very comfortable, but I'm like many people. If you scratch the surface, there's a bit of the desperado inside. My nickname as a child was Desperate Ambrose, and I think if you scratch most homeowners, men and women, you will find a kind of streak of some wild man or wild woman who wants to get out. I think that's true. At least I worked on this novel in the faith that it was.
I've left you a minute for this question. I'm sorry. Do you ever do something that shocks yourself? Are you ever really shocked at what you feel or what you do?
Yes. Not very often, but sometimes I find myself, particularly when I'm in a strange city, when I'm traveling and there's no set agenda, I'll start wandering around and finding myself in a place I hadn't expected to be. I think that anybody who sits down to write stories had better become fairly well acquainted with their shadow side, because it's that shadow side that gives an interesting kind of darkness, the bass notes, to a story. I think if you felt that you yourself were completely justified in everything that you did, and you had all of your impulses completely under control, well, I don't know where the stories would come from, because I think stories tend to start when things begin to go wrong. And the more you have a sense of your own potential for that, the more interesting your stories will be.
Charles Baxter teaches at the University of Michigan. His new novel, Shadow Play, is published by Norton. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy with Sue Weinstein. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the man who brought the inner workings of government into our living rooms, we meet Brian Lamb. He's the founder and CEO of C-SPAN. Viewers also know him as a C-SPAN host. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.